The Institute for the Humanities at Salado presents Understanding Vietnam, code 9-48-82, entitled Summing Up of Symposium and Discussion with Audience. Speaker Stryker McGuire.
You who aren't, turn to the person next to you. Do not shake hands, slug them. That should do it. Unaccustomed as I am to public speaking, between two elephants, I want to say that I'm Liz Carpenter. I was born in Slado and lived to tell about it. And I'm here to introduce your friendly wind-up speaker, Stryker McGuire, the brilliant young journalist who headed the staff that made this special issue on Vietnam possible. Harry Wilmer has allowed me, though, 5 minutes first to say what's on my mind, and I've never been one to turn down that kind of offer. So first I want to say a word about the elephants. When I grew up here, we didn't know any. I was 17 years old before I saw my first Republican and 21 before I saw my first Roman Catholic, and both were terrifying experiences. And the Slado I knew, we didn't even have any Episcopalians except a handful. We were Methodists, Baptists, and Democrats. But we knew Episcopalians for what they really are. And that's Neiman Marcus Methodist. And then we didn't know anything about Republicans. 2 years ago, a whole herd got loose in this county, and we came to know elephants for what they really are. Clumsy, greedy, stomping out everything in sight. My friends, take a look. You may be seeing the last two elephants in Bell County. They belong to Jack Jones. Well, one of the nice things about Slado is that you can say almost anything you want to, give or take a few words. And that's why I think we have been riveted really, Harry. And I agree so much with what Max Sherrill said yesterday. He said, I'm so proud of Harry Wilmer, I could bust. I'm so proud of Slado, I could bust. Would all the people in Slado who put this show on stand up? Let's hear it. They were fabulous. We promise you that you will not live to regret it. In fact, we want to come back in 2 years. And we're going to bring a whole new set of folks, and we're going to hear from Gino, who's going to come back from his speaking circuit on military bases and tell us how it is. We really needed everybody here who came. And it would have lacked a lot if everybody had not come. It would have lacked a lot if Walt Rostow hadn't given up a weekend in Austin to be here and to be willing to sit up here and take some of the stuff you've poured out. And he feels that's his commitment, and I'm for it. It would have lacked a lot if our classy generals, and they were pretty classy, and you know, they were the most sympathetic generals I've ever been around, hadn't been willing. So let's see who we are. How many people here are psychotherapists? And I throw all of the brain people in together. Who are the brain trust here? Everybody's in the brain trust. My gosh. Well, you're looking for clients, I take it. Some of us will be ready for you. How many people are educators? Teachers, how many people are Vietnam veterans? How many people are wives of Vietnam veterans? We'd like to hear from you next time. They must be hell to live with. It's been hell everywhere. How many of you are doctors? Well, we said that. And how many of you are lawyers? Okay. Well, I will refrain from asking how many of you are Democrats. But as you see, we all needed each other because the Vietnam story is still being written. We haven't finished it. We won't finish it. We're still learning from each other. Nobody can possibly understand each other's experiences unless we listen to them. Because it may was hell in Vietnam, but it wasn't any picnic in the White House either. We've all had corns that have gotten stepped on. And I'm going to mention the corn that I have that got stepped on because nobody else has mentioned it. And that was done by the speaker who so blithely suggested that the erosion of male confidence is due to the women's movement and the disappearance of males' clubs. Well, I can remember specifically asking Gloria Steinem, do you favor clubs for men? And she said, with a straight face, only when all else fails. And yesterday afternoon, I didn't know whether I was listening to Gene McCarthy or Jesse Helms, but I do know that on the speaker circuit I travel, which is out in the legislatures of the unratified states where the old boys network lives, male erosion really hadn't set in. And I'll tell you one thing, we can hardly wait till it does. But in Arizona and the Carolinas and Florida and Utah, the old boys do talk to the new boys, and what they say is, to borrow a phrase, lies. So don't think that the message from Slado is that we need to reestablish all male situations or all male clubs to restore their confidence. There ought to be doubts in men. It's about time. And most of us who have thought or fought for equality and justice know it would have been a lot more just country if Abigail had been there with John in Philadelphia, not instead of having to write him to remember the ladies. But you all know, and this is my corn, and it may be trivial to you, but it's a great moment to me, so I have to say something about it. And I think it's of some moment here to other women. Women have been systematically dealt out of the economic equality when lawyers' clubs exclude women lawyers and when press clubs exclude women journalists. And yes, when women who want to serve their country in the military are only asked, can you type? Well, as I say, that isn't the message from Slado, though it's one I'll carry away. But I don't think that we should identify the Vietnam veterans' cause with turning the clock back on women or on the war on poverty. The message from Slado and of this conference, I think, is what has happened to all of us and in all of us since you gathered us here, Harry. And I found that message most poignantly yesterday in the musty old parlor of the house where I was born in this town when our discussion group met and talked and listened to Gino. And I thought as I sat there how far we've had to come from the time that I grew up there and the world was really not with us. We didn't know where Asia was. In fact, we didn't even know where Austin, Texas was. We really met the world in the early 20s through Richard Halliburton's Seven League Boots or listening to our grandmother's missionary circles talk about taking our outgrown clothes and putting them in a barrel and shipping them to the heathen Chinese. Well, Vietnam was there yesterday and today, embodied in all those young veterans who have shared their stories and agonies with us, and we thank you for that. We thank you for your patience. We thank you for what you did in Vietnam, and we thank you for what you did in Slado. You do have to be patient with us. But we're all better, and we are all greater disciples of your cause because you cared enough to come and to talk from the heart and to shout at us sometime. I was asked yesterday by a woman I respect tremendously, Vivian Castleberry, who's been a reporter for the Dallas Times Herald, Liz, you were at the White House. What was it like? Well, you know, it's a funny thing. Nobody has ever asked me that before. And I will tell you that Vietnam was with us every hour in every event. You had to keep the show on the road. You had to keep things going on many, many fronts. But I think I'll tell you, because I was in the East Wing, I was not over there where the lights burned all night, where the Situation Room was told to call the president when the mission got back because he wanted to know how it went. I was not over there, but I was where you could hear the din of ugly voices. Hey, hey, LBJ, how many kids did you kill today? And I was there when you were trying to think your way through to do what was right for your country, and where you were trying to help a war on poverty go. And I think that you all want a war on poverty to go. My God, many of you came out of poverty. You know what it is, the difference when you have a Head Start project. And so a few of the things that you felt in that house was, for instance, and many things that maybe you didn't know, was that there was a constant searching and a constant vigilance and a tremendous anguish. The president was never a man to sleep anyway, and he didn't sleep many hours. There were nightmares there. And as Lady Bird said, very much in the wake of the assassination, it's all been a dreadful nightmare, but somehow we had to have the strength to go on. So there were nightmares everywhere, and we did have to have the strength to go on. Perhaps you didn't know that also, you know, I was amazed when my reporter friends would say, does the president know that this opposition to the war effort? You know, are they crazy? There are two tickers and three TV sets and that noise from outside, and still the president was calling in people to talk to him. Here is a man who had spent about 37 years of his life in Congress, and yet every morning he woke up to read that another Senate friend had run an ad against him. That wasn't very easy when you're trying to run the country. It wasn't easy to do a lot of what you might consider trivial things. Mrs. Johnson felt that she could be a translator of the Great Society. We would plan trips to take the press to go out and walk through a Head Start project or through a War on Poverty, a teacher's corps up in Appalachia, where maybe, because there were teacher's corpsmen there, more kids would walk down that mountain after the fifth grade and go through high school. And yet you knew that surely, as sure I'm sitting here, there'd be two pickets there, and the story would go down the drain. You'd never really get the story told that you were trying to help tell. So the War on Poverty story was never told, and probably there's nobody that knows that 13 million people were lifted off the public dole in those years, which is somehow miraculous. And it affected things like head of state visits, because the country has to go on. There are 167 nations in this world, and most of them come calling, some of them three or four times a year. The White House has to have meetings with them. It's reflected itself in a strange way. We more and more found that the entertainers who came there, and you would often have a soprano or a poet, were likely to spit on you and turn the whole thing to their advantage. Well, we found one thing out about 1967. Ballet dancers don't demonstrate. They can't ruin their leg muscles. So we had a lot of ballet dancers in the last year of the White House. And as we were trying to persuade Harold Wilson and the Britishers to please join their old ally. Well, that's all I have to say, except it was not easy anywhere, and only by knowing each other's experiences can we come out of this constructively. Stryker McGuire is going to try to round it all up, and I think he will. He's among the best and the brightest, and I want to say I thank Phil Jalen and Stryker for coming down here. The media takes a lot of flack, too, and I think we've seen a very classic twosome in these two gentlemen. And Stryker started out in Hamilton, New York, and learned Spanish. And he is, it served him well because he has covered a number of altercations. Where are my notes on Stryker?
under your 5 minutes.
Under my 5 minutes speech. Well, Stryker There. Stryker, we're getting awfully uppity, you know. Stryker helped cover the civil unrest in Nicaragua and the deposed Shah of Iran's stay in Panama. And then his knowledge of Spanish led him to Newsweek. He is chief of the bureau in Houston. He, as I told you, helped put together this issue, which won the National Magazine Award. And he went out and personally interviewed 35 veterans from San Juan to Seattle. And I have known him 2 days now. He is half Dutch and half Irish and a wonderful inquiring mind that is going to round up all of the things we've been listening to, and we're going to walk out of here clear as a bell. Stryker McGuire.
I think so that you'll all know, I'm going to be giving a 10-minute speech. After this morning, this wonderful inquiring mind went through his speech and decided that to take all the light out of it and leave all the darkness in it, and I figured that if what happened this morning happened after Phil Jalin said that he was going to provide us with some comic relief, that I'd better do something to this speech. I let Robert Bly take his bouzouki with him. I really am honored to be able to summarize and gloss the collective wisdom and pronouncements of our distinguished speakers this weekend. I'm also, I must confess, very grateful for the opportunity to do to them what my editors do to me every week. That is brutally compress, interpret, and even put my own impressionistic spin on what they have said and what they have suggested. I relish the chance to do this, and I hope I appreciate the responsibility inherent in such a task. Our speakers clearly labored long and hard on the presentations that they gave to us. It's important to remember that what each speaker has said to us is a distillation of a lifetime of work. That's not true in my case, but I think in the case of most of the other speakers here, that is true. Each of them has performed a public service, not just here in Salado this weekend, but throughout their careers in and out of government, as well-intended participants in some cases, or as thoughtful observers. We may not agree with everything or even anything that each one of them said this weekend, but we are, I think, indebted to them for at least having taken the time now and then. Liz mentioned earlier that she was going to give her elephant speech to try to diffuse some of the hostility that was in the room this morning, and there have been some hard feelings, even some rancor, expressed here. But that, too, has a purpose, and we might as well get it out. Perhaps we should have gotten it out a little earlier. Perhaps this symposium should have been held earlier. But we're here, and we're dealing with a lot of perhaps, and it's perhaps about time. Before I get into my brisk review, I'd like to turn it topsy-turvy for a second and express my gratitude and that of the other speakers to the Institute, to its directors and advisors, and especially to Harry Wilmer for inviting us to participate and for assembling such an interesting, interested, and not infrequently challenging audience. The simple fact that this symposium has been held says something that is, in its own way, as eloquent as some of the remarks of our speakers. A silence is being broken, and we are, as a nation, awakening like some of Harry Wilmer's dreamers and dealing, finally, with our nightmares. I would agree with Dr. Wilmer that this has therapeutic value, and even with Robert Bly, that there is a need to address the dark side, be it the dark side of foreign policy, the dark side of the execution of the war, or the dark side of war itself, the Vietnam War, or any other war. I would disagree, and I'm certainly not the first this weekend, with Walt Rostow, if I've understood him correctly, that the greatest healing gift is a kind of generational forgetfulness. Professor Rostow told us that for the young now, the Vietnam War is as far away as the Civil War. And he added, thank God for that. I can't speak for the younger generation, not anymore, but I think that what Dr. Rostow said of the real world view vis-a-vis the poetic view applies also to the legacy of Vietnam, and that is that we cannot wish it away. It's not that we haven't tried. By the time Saigon fell in 1975, 2 years after the last U.S. soldiers left Vietnam, America had already begun to shroud its Vietnam experience in a silence of shame and embarrassment. So profound was the silence that its message fairly screamed in the mind of the Vietnam veteran, let's not talk about it. So we didn't, and they didn't. Now this symposium has taken place, and there are a number of other signs that the cloak of silence is lifting. It's as if a grown man were finally coming to grips with something nightmarish that happened to him as a child. The controversial Vietnam Memorial in Washington will be dedicated on Veterans Day, 11 days from now. And my colleague, Phil Gélin, which is, by the way, how the name is pronounced, calls this belated, controversial memorial a metaphor on the war itself, a monument to dichotomy. The memorial, he says, invites questioning. It does, and so do a lot of other things, and that's why we're all here. Among the signs that have come up and that will be coming up in the future as to the fact that the nation is awakening to its nightmare are several compilations of Vietnam reminiscences. I think somebody mentioned this morning this afternoon Santoli's book. It was Baker's book, and there are a number of other books. There are a number of new books, including Dr. Wilmer's and maybe Phil's, and one by a Newsweek reporting team that will be published over the next year. And there's Richard Ellison's TV commentary. There people are talking about it. I should stress at the same time that the silence has hardly been total. Profound, perhaps, but not really total. Our speakers, for example, have been dealing with Vietnam for at least a decade in a very active way. But for Vietnam veterans, and perhaps for the nation as a whole, the need to talk, to grieve, if you will, or as Robert Bly said, to mourn, now seems nearly as profound as the very eerie silence that preceded it. Grieving is not a happy process, nor is the rehashing, which we have been doing for much of this weekend. But they can be productive, and those of us here this weekend can take some comfort from that. The process that we are as a nation going through is not an easy one. Dr. Wilmer reminded us that it takes courage to remember Vietnam. Robert Bly, who came flying at us like the burning baby in his poem, said to us, I read that poem not because I wanted to. He read it to us not just out of what has been called his raw revolt, but also because we asked him to in a way, however indirectly and however unconsciously. And Vietnam veterans have been responding to us, and we inadequately in turn to them for similar reasons. Dr. Wilmer told us about the veteran who, in explaining why he had bottled up his nightmares, said, nobody's asked me, Doc. This is an oft-heard refrain among Vietnam veterans. When the four Newsweek reporters, including myself, set out to interview a company of Vietnam veterans a year and a half ago, we were astounded by the overwhelming, heartrending at times, response from a group of men who had not talked about the war much to anybody, not even to their own families. And one vet was asked why they hadn't, and he responded, echoing Harry Wilmer's vet, because nobody asked. As we've been told this weekend, the story of the war and its impact on America and on Americans is that simple and at the same time that complex. In Richard Ellison's painstakingly researched documentary, we heard Lyndon Johnson say that to know war is to know that there is still madness in this world. As we learned from George Herring and Doug Kennard, the Vietnam War was, in its planning and its execution, particularly well endowed with a kind of seeming madness anyway. It seemed especially off its rocker to infantrymen in Vietnam in late 1968 and early 1969. The war was at a crossroads then. At home, Middle America had turned against the war in the wake of the Tet Offensive early in 1968. In Vietnam, the war itself was going sour, even as the U.S. commitment of troops to it was reaching its peak of 543,000. Peace conferees in Paris, after 5 weeks of dickering, had finally decided on the shape of the bargaining table. And this was news that reached American troops in Nam during some of the heaviest fighting of the war. I'd like to read to you a brief passage from the war section of Newsweek's Chronicle about Charlie Company, 2nd Battalion, 28th Infantry Regiment of the 1st Infantry Division, the Big Red One. And I hope that there were enough copies for all of you to get these. I'm sure a lot of you had not read them before, and maybe at your leisure you will do so. Anyway, let me just read this one section to you. One day in the war, a flight of choppers lifted off into the blood-red dusk over the Iron Triangle and embattled wild northwest of Saigon, bearing the grunts of Charlie Company back to Lai K for a breather. Their trail-weary legs dangled from open doors. They hugged their M16s to their bare and mostly scrawny chests. Their teenage faces were masks of impassivity, gazing without expression at the deserted outpost receding swiftly below them. They had carved it out with their sweat and held it with their blood, and then had it abandoned like Julie and Cantigny and the others. All that remained to show they had even been there were their empty bunkers, and spray painted in big letters across one of them, the single exasperated word, crazy. The graffito was their primal shout to the world, their declaration that the war was mad and they were not. As Harry Wilmer knows, that declaration or the recognition of that has been particularly important to the healing process among veterans. Was the war crazy? I think George Herring and Doug Kennard have told us it was not really, that the series of decisions which got the United States more and more deeply involved in Vietnam were too deliberate to add up to madness.
This is the end of side one. Please turn your tape over and continue on side two.